Hi, podcasters. This is Andy Studna, Associate Editor of Applied Clinical Trials, and I'm here today with our Editor-in-Chief, Lisa Henderson. For today's episode, we are speaking with Dr. Ian Smith, Founder, Director, and Chief Medical Officer of Panthera Biopartners.
So Ian was awarded the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire in July 2012 for services in health research in regard to Sonexus Health Research. In addition to his leadership at Panthera, he is a non-executive director of several healthcare companies. And also joining Ian today is Chris Dodd, the Chief Commercial Officer of Panthera Biopartners. So thank you for joining us today, Ian and Chris.
Pleasure.
Yes, thank you both for joining us today. So Ian, starting with your career, what inspired you to form Sonexus in the late 90s?
Actually, Andrew, it was more the early 90s, really. I was a practicing doctor in the UK. Like a lot of clinicians, you know, I was involved in a few small clinical trials each year, two or three, you know, involving tiny numbers of patients. And, you know, sad to say, 30 years down the line, that's probably still how most clinical trials are recruited, you know, opportunistically in a clinical setting. So squeezing research patients into a probably an already very busy clinic. So I had this idea that if we separated that research activity from the day-to-day effort of running a clinic, we could streamline the process and we would no longer be using opportunistic recruitment, but, you know, more sophisticated and targeted recruitment methods. And it would also give us the opportunity to try and persuade other doctors to alert their patients to studies that were going on in what became a dedicated research unit. So we took some staff, separated them from the clinical staff, and put them in a building separate from the clinic. And that team was dedicated to recruiting and retaining patients in clinical trials. And I think I'm right in saying that the first dedicated research site that we started was around about 1992. And that was the start of the Sonexus model, if you like. So we had 6,000 patients in our practice. That was the total number that we could recruit from. And by the time we'd sort of collected colleagues in the area, we went up to just under 200,000 patients. So it completely transformed our activities. And of course, the staff who were working there were not trying to provide clinical care at the same time as recruiting and randomizing patients into clinical trials. And the industry loved it. You know, we were very, very quickly swamped with work and shortly afterwards started to increase the number of sites and, you know, over the subsequent years, internationalize the business and buy existing businesses in places like South Africa and Germany. So by the time John and I set up the current business, which is Panthera, I had been left Sonexus for quite a number of years. So I had a gap in my career and a bit of a rest, if you mind.
Now, I remember when the SMO concept gained a lot of traction, it was discussed a lot in industry, you know, later in those intervening years. So when you launched Panthera, what prompted that move?
Well, that's pretty easy, really. I mean, my co-founder is Professor John Lyon, who was global VP of Covance for many, many years. So John comes from a CRO background. And of course, what we had seen is the acquisition of all the significant SMOs have been acquired by CROs. And, you know, we could do a whole podcast on this, but there are difficulties for a CRO running an SMO because they are very, very different roles. And we have interesting conversations with people from the CRO area. So John and I wanted to create an exemplar patient recruitment business, independent, so not owned or affiliated with a CRO, so that we focus entirely on recruitment and retention of patients into clinical trials. That's all we do. And I think, if you want me to be honest, I think that's the reason we're good at it, because we don't mix it with any other activities.
That's a really good point. And the large CROs have kind of become giant. You know, they're not just large, they're huge, and they want to do everything from end to end. So you make a really good point that you focus on what you do well. And I also noticed, as they get bigger and everything, that they want to change what they call themselves. You know, they don't want to be just a contract researcher. They just don't like that or something. They want to be something else. And same with maybe an SMO. So getting into the terminology, why do you think that is? I don't know if that makes any sense, but obviously you do recruitment and retention really well. And that is what makes Panthera an SMO.
I think I'm going to jump in on this one, if that's okay.
Yeah, please, Chris.
I guess essentially all of these organizations, when you think about businesses and their heritage, they're all relatively new organizations. You know, CROs were really scaling up over the last 20 years, changing their offering, growing geographically as well as in their service offerings. And I think part of their evolution is to step out of a previous typecast and to redefine themselves based on the unique services that they're able to offer versus that of their competitors. Now, I think a similar scenario occurred in the SMO world, in that the idea of, I guess, Ian's concept or what he birthed was the control of the site, the control of patient flow using strategic patient outreach, and the control of all members of staff in that site. And what you may have seen over the space of the last 20 years is various adapted versions of that. So there's fully owned site models, there are affiliate site models or partnership models. And I think the SMO brand was synonymous with all of these types of, I guess, organizations, even though many of them have very different operating models. So what we're wanting to do here in this scenario now is almost reframe what we are as an organization, which is, I guess, a cluster of people that have been working in site management with sites that we own, manage, and staff ourselves, and that have been doing so for, well, since the inception of the concept of SMOs. So what we're trying to say is, you know, we don't have affiliate night. We're not managing 200 sites, none of which we own, none of which we control, and many of which are still running clinics, which is, I guess, against the original concept that Ian came up with. We are still true to that original model, which is that our sites are wholly owned sites. They are sites that do research and nothing else. And that is why we are able to offer the enhanced offering that we give our clients.
You're right, pointing out the different models. I think that sometimes it might get confusing, and it does make a lot of sense to look under the hood and see how those models, how they relate to each other, how the physician, wherever they are, you know, what they're doing. So thank you so much. That really makes a lot of sense. So we've seen decentralized and hybrid trials talked a lot over the last 7 years, I would say, but clearly during COVID and post-COVID now, there's been a lot of talk about hybrid trials. And so no one would say that a site is not necessary, but these models do rely more on remote pieces. So how does Panthera account for DCT components?
Essentially, the Synexus model and now the Panthera model was always based on a principle of what we would call a hub and spoke mechanism of accessing patients. Idea being, there is a central site, but then there are multiple other sites that would feed that central site to make it a bigger, better offering when it comes to patient access and patient recruitment. Now, as time evolves, it's not only sites that we're talking to, it's primary care, secondary care. We can access people via social media. So that hub and spoke model is evolving, it's growing, it's doing all those things. And we're now in a position where we can make that two-directional. So the staff that we have at our sites, because they are our staff and because we manage all the operational delivery at said sites, there's nothing stopping us from sending staff to our patients, thus making it a fully remote position, or blending to make a hybrid solution whereby our patients can remotely access our PIs. We can send out staff to them, bring them to us. We have a range of flexibility at our sites between, I guess, site-based, hybrid, and decentralized that's available to us. I don't think many other organizations can have, just because of our structure.
I think the other thing that I'd add to what Chris has said is that, yes, you know, there's a lot of talk going on about decentralized and hybrid studies. The sort of studies that we're currently involved in, I mean, quite simply, most of them couldn't be run as a completely decentralized model because, you know, we bring patients in for CT scanning, MRI, blood testing, x-rays, mammograms. Not too easy to do a PET scan in somebody's lounge. Whilst there's been masses of discussion about this, we have yet to see a pure decentralized study. I've been around a long time. As you know, I just don't see the pure decentralized model working. Shall I say in regulatory phase two and phase three trials? You know, if you're testing maybe a shampoo or something, that might be different. But just to finish off this, my comment, the hybrid side of it is of huge interest to us because, you know, just from an ethical perspective, if we can interview a patient on a Teams call for a particular visit, or even to talk to them initially about their suitability and willingness to take part in the trial, of course, things like that can be done remotely. And there's no reason why we wouldn't do that. I think we've to test the model in a proper way, just to make sure that if you do initial consultations remotely, you get the quality of patient recruitment that you get if you are seeing them face-to-face in the clinic. But certainly there is a place for remote activity, I guess, in most clinical trials.
Yeah, you make a really good point. I mean, obviously, especially with the sophistication of a lot of the therapies, you just can't have it completely decentralized. So you make a really good point.
Chris and Ian, both of you can jump in on these next few questions. But the first one, what do you think is the single most consistent trend in clinical trials over the years that either of you have seen?
Underperformance. I think no matter how well you plan a clinical trial, they're consistently getting more complicated and more difficult to run. And therefore, the likelihood of achieving the original protocol plan is getting more and more unlikely, or it's more and more difficult to achieve. So I think that's been in place for a long period of time. It's very, very well documented. And I think the certainty of delivery of any clinical trial at the complexity that most phase two, phase three trials are at mean that underperformance is almost guaranteed.
I think one of the other, if you want to call it a trend, and we can only speak for the UK, is that with the 2.5 years we've had with COVID in the background, there's been a huge reduction in clinical trial activity outside the SMO space because the clinicians are either not seeing patients face-to-face at all, and believe it or not, that is still happening in the UK, where all consultations are remote unless the patient is in physical danger. And that has changed, I think, changed the approach of the sponsors. If you like, it's pushing more sponsors in the direction of the SMO players, which obviously is good. I think that's a trend that will probably continue. But, you know, to get it all in proportion, figures that Ken Getz published 25 years ago, for example, you know, the average number of patients per site, per study, is still less than 5 worldwide. Now, in a dedicated research model like ours, that would be 5 or 10 times that. And obviously the cost implications for that for the sponsor and the data quality where, you know, the staff are only filling in 1 or 2 CRFs per protocol, you know, have a profound effect on the quality and out of the study. And obviously, just to repeat what we said before, I mean, the trend we've all been talking about is remote data capture and, you know, making trials virtual, but we've not really seen much progress in that.
What do you see as how things will evolve in the next 5 to 7 years, maybe? What kind of changes do you see on the horizon?
Yeah, I think there's no doubt that certainly virtual consultations will play a much bigger role in studies. And we're absolutely convinced that that's the right way forward.
One of the things I'd like to say is better utilization of data. So, you know, there are many countries across the world that have got great data platforms that store really key information about patients that are suffering with various ailments that maybe sit within regions that don't have access to research, or even if they do, they're not fully aware as to what research is, what studies are out there, so on and so forth. So I think if we evolve as an organization and the market continues to evolve, what we will be pushing for and what I think the market needs to push for is better utilization of that data so that we can get more information and more access to patients and vice versa. I think that's got to happen because otherwise, I guess it would be a underperformance on everybody who sits in this space to allow these patients not to get the additional benefit that's available.
To the point of when you were discussing separating the research from the clinical care, but more and more the language around patients and participants slash subjects is different. Do you think that leads to people less understand that they are part of a study and this isn't necessarily care?
I think that is down to the quality of the site staff.
Mm-hmm.
So our patients all have another doctor looking after them out in the community. In the UK, everybody has a GP.
Right.
And we work very closely with the GP. So if a patient decides to take part in a Panthera-run study, keep the GPs totally informed about everything that happens to them, you know, any abnormalities we find in screening, the fact that the patient's consented to take part in the study. And, you know, we also get detailed historical medical information. So we are very, very keen on making sure that the patients understand that we are not providing their clinical care. And if we felt that they needed clinical care outside the study because they were taking part in the study, you know, say with a serious adverse event or something like that, we would simply contact their primary physician and the patient would go to them for management of any other clinical conditions. So I think our patients certainly are well aware that they are, A, volunteering to take part in an ethically approved clinical trial, and that they will always have access to their primary clinical doctor, as well as the doctors and staff at our site.
Well, thank you so much, Ian, and thank you, Chris, for joining us today. Did you have anything to add?
To your last point and to all points in general, I think the key thing here, organization, we believe that if the message gets out there and the communication is out there that research is available, that research can help healthcare outcomes, and that it's a positive thing, whether it's with our organization or any other organization out there, that's something that will, you know, help the community, help the countries that are able to offer this research to patients out there. We want this to be first and foremost for patients.
Excellent. Thanks, Chris. Thank you, Ian. Thanks again for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for asking.
Thank you both.
Hey, listeners. Nico Saraceno, Associate Editor and co-host of the Pharmaceutical Commerce podcast here with a sneak peek of Julian Upton's conversation with Ushank Agarwal of HutchMed and his insight on being able to track the patient journey in the complex and rare diseases space, along with how to get the best out of data in this area.
Understanding the patient journey really allows us to deep dive, and especially in the United States where the data is so granular, to really understand where do we fit in and where can we really benefit those patients, where to find those patients that will be eligible for our drug, because there is a sequence in treatment. A lot of oncology drugs, you can see they are indicated for later lines. And even within later lines, there are biomarker requirements and other things. Understanding that patient journey really allows us to figure out which is that exact population and where is that population sitting with which physicians, which hospitals, so that we can create awareness within those key accounts